All right, good morning, everyone. If you've got your New Testament with you, you might be turning over to the book of Romans. We're going to be looking at Romans, the 14th chapter. Larry, that sounds very loud to me. Is that all right? Or okay, I'm just loud this morning. Got a call from Benjamin just a few minutes ago, and he woke up with his stomach hurting pretty badly and didn't think he was going to be able to make it out this morning. So I'll do the last-minute fill-in here. And I think he just didn't want to teach Romans 14 again, but it's an interesting chapter and a lot of things to discuss in it. And we spent a little bit last week on it, but we said we were going to spend one more week, and I think that's good. There's a lot of discussion, a few more principles and things to go over. So we'll be doing that this morning. Before we start, Rob, you want to lead us in a word of prayer, please? If we look at the first verse of Romans 14, it gives us a sort of guiding thesis statement for the rest of the chapter. Somebody tell me what that is. The thesis statement. What is it? Verse 1. Okay, that is one way of stating it. How does he explicitly state it there? Okay, some translations say receive, some translations say accept, but it says accept or receive the one who is weak in the faith. I like whenever you have a starting point, okay? We can always refer back to that, right? The rest of this is part of that discussion on how we have to do that. Now, there's a couple of things that are implied in all of these verses as we go through this chapter that I think we also need to keep in mind. Who are the people under consideration who are going to have to work with each other? What's their relationship? They're Christians. Okay, let's keep that in mind. One of the things that came up last week as we were talking about this whole matter of conscience was somebody brought up, well, conscience can't be your guide. Well, it can if your conscience is trained according to God's word. And when he starts going into some of the principles, which we'll get to in a minute, then we have to start understanding two other things about the way this work puts together. One are, what are the general guidelines that he's using, and what are the specific examples that he's covering? Because if it only applies to the two specific things that are mentioned in this chapter, then it doesn't do us much good, because those aren't as big a problem these days, although we'll talk about at least one of them that still is. But the principles that he's laying down, the general guidelines that he's using so that people can understand how to apply that, those things are universal. And so I think as we go through this, we need to be careful to try to pull those out and see how that affects us and how we incorporate that into how we live and how we interact with our brothers. So on this whole matter of conscience, if, you know, someone has studied the scripture and has come to a conclusion about something, then their conscience from the scripture says, dictates their behavior. Someone else may come to a slightly different conclusion. Now, does that mean that there's no absolute truth here? Is that what we're talking about? No. How many people have ever held an opinion And then when you got more information or grew older or whatever came along, suddenly decided, maybe I need to change my mind on that. Anybody here never change their mind on anything? Okay, I know the ladies are not going to raise their hands, right? That is a right, a sacred right to be able to change your mind. You know, my wife comes out and asks me when we're fixing to go somewhere, does this look okay? You know, that's one of those questions that has no correct answer. Okay? And she reserves the right to say whether it does or doesn't, and if she decides to change her mind and go put on something else, that's okay. And I have to accept that. But he's got some important things in mind here when he says we need to accept those who are weak in the faith. And then he goes ahead and he talks about two topics, verses 2 through 5, kind of handle two topics that are specific to that congregation that have to be addressed. Now, what are those two topics? Okay, food is one of them, and in particular, meat sacrificed to idols, I think, seems to be the underlying thing, especially since you see that same theme coming up in 1 Corinthians, the 8th chapter. But he has a second one that he mentions as well. Special days, okay? So both of those would have been things that they had to deal with back then. Now, we've talked about this church having a combination of Greeks and Gentiles, Jews and Gentiles, and the differences that those cultures are going to make when they have to live and work together. You're going to have people who were Jewish, who are coming out of Judaism, who are going to have to wrestle with the concepts of what they're eating in terms of diet, and also with the special days that they, you know, had on their calendar before. You're going to have Gentiles who are coming out of idolatry. And folks, they had things that meant something to them when they ate them. And they also had special days that they considered. How many people know where we got a lot of the names for the days of the week? A lot of it's from Greek mythology, right? Okay, we say Greek mythology, but and for us, they're myths, right? But to the Greeks, those were their gods. What's Thursday? That's Thor's day, right? Okay, and you know, everybody knows the movie Thor, so we know how all that goes out. But for them, they were their gods. And so we're still left with a legacy of some of the days that they had and that they dedicated, even just in our calendar and things. We just don't think about it that way much anymore. Which gives you another point. Can things change over time? And the meaning of something change over time? It certainly can, and sometimes we have to adjust, and we'll talk about that a little bit more as we go. Okay, so now let's talk about some principles, okay? He's got these two specific problems, and he's told them what they have to do as the guiding line there. And now he's going to call into the discussion guidelines that they are to use when they are in this situation trying to decide what their actions are. So, verses 3 and 4 introduce what I think is one of the overlying principles that we just have to keep in mind when we're having any kind of discussion with anyone. What is that? Look at those verses and tell me. What's the general principle there?
Not to judge.
Okay, not to judge, but there's a specific reason why. God is the judge. That's really what he's getting down to, right? And brethren, that's something that we really, really need to keep in mind. Because even though we study and we want to do what's right and we can be fully convinced that we're right, we still need to keep in mind that that doesn't make us the judge. Now, we need to be able to discuss those things. We need to be able to talk those things. We need to be able to share and try to convince each other from the scriptures what our positions are. But we need to do that with that understanding that we're not the judge. Why does that make a difference? Why does that make a difference? Okay, that's certainly part of it.
We have that spirit.
Okay.
You know, if it's left up to us to judge, I mean, we clearly become divisive because when we state a point, we obviously think we're right.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's divisive. Same thing, it disrupts unity.
Okay, you can disrupt that because you get to a point where, you know, we've got this human nature that's built into us. I don't know, there's this thing called competition. Competition is healthy. It can be good. But there are times when it can be bad, too. And you just have to, you know, understand where that is. But when two people get down and discuss something, a lot of times we get an attitude of, it's not a discussion. Right? What is it? It's a battle. And I have to win. And if I don't win, then that is a bad reflection on me somehow. And what we have to understand is that not understanding something or not being right or even to the point of ignorance on a subject is not shame. Children are born ignorant. And sometime by the time we die, we want to assuage part of that ignorance. But it's a lifelong process of learning. And if we look at it that way, and always as an opportunity to learn and to discuss and to better understand what your brother is thinking, we'd wind up being able to get along a whole lot better on a lot of issues. Again, keep in mind, that doesn't mean that it doesn't that there's not an absolute right or wrong. What it means is that God's going to be the one to ultimately draw that line and that we have to reserve that for him. It's really no different than when we look at the Psalms. Anybody know what the imprecatory Psalms are? I just wouldn't come out there. Thank you. The imprecatory Psalms. Those are psalms that are, they sound really bad, you know. I hope that the enemy comes and dashes their children's heads against the rocks. And we look at them and go, oh my goodness, what is he doing? Why was David doing things like that? But if you look at it in turning that over to God, you know, he was saying, God, I want you to judge these people. Now, that's an okay thing to say, but it was God's judgment then. It wasn't that David was saying, I'm going to go do this. I'm the one who's going to carry this out. And so it's putting things in God's hands. And that's a lot of what we have to do. So God is the judge. Let's keep that principle in mind. Second thing. Look at verse 13. And tell me if there's a principle there that we need to pay attention to. What's the principle there? Joe, you're nodding your head. Don't put a stumbling block in your brother's way. Tell me why that's important. Okay. Your actions or discussion or argument or whatever can have an impact on someone else's faith and behavior. And I hope that when we stand before the judgment seat of God, that we will have more positive influence on our brothers than we will negative. And so when he's saying, don't put a stumbling block in the way, basically he's saying, you, whichever side you're on, weak or strong there, depending on how you argue this, and of course it's everyone thinks they're arguing from the strong brother's standpoint, could be causing more harm than good if it's not done properly. Now, does he say that they shouldn't discuss these things? Is that ever under consideration? Certainly, and that's part of our conclusion is if this is something that is going to cause somebody else to have problems, to discourage them, to get them, you know, to cause them to lose part of their faith, or to cause them to violate their conscience, to do something that they're not fully convinced is right. And that's another principle that we see coming in several places, isn't it? What does he say about, look at verse 5, another principle there. Missed one as I went down my little list here. It's also repeated again in verses, effectively 22 and verse 23 as well. What's the principle there?
Faith.
Okay, it is faith. Absolutely faith. Be fully convinced. What does that mean? Fully convinced. No, go right ahead. Yeah. What? Okay, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Rob? Okay, and that's a lot of what he's talking about there. When he says don't be the judge, the other thing he brings up in that is this whole thing of each one of those people in this weak, strong relationship thinks that they are serving God, right? And so God is each of theirs judge, and so it's like, well, who are you to judge the slave of another? Okay, let's get the relationships right here. We are slaves to God, and that's where our first allegiance is, and that's where we have to make sure that we're doing the best that we can to please our God. And sometimes there's more than one way to do things, and so we just have to work through them and get to a point where people can worship and serve their God in a way that you can be joined together. Now, so we got this, that principle of not judging. We got the principle of being fully convinced. We've got not putting a stumbling block, and very closely related there in verse 20, I think there's one other principle that we got to keep in mind. What's it say there? Verse 20. I think I got the right verse.
Don't tear down the work of God.
Okay. He says, don't tear down the work of God. And in this case, he mentions the specific thing, for the sake of food. But I think the general principle there is, don't tear down the work of God. Folks, it's really hard in this world to get people to understand the basics of the gospel. And then we need to grow from there. That's not where we need to stay. That's where we start, right? And that's even harder to get us all to grow into the strength and maturity that we need as Christians to function well in this world and to have a good, strong, positive influence on the world. And so let's not mess that up. He's saying, let's not mess that up. Okay, so we've got some principles, guiding principles. I want to give you an example of a discussion that y'all have never heard of, which is always good because then nobody has got a dog in this fight in this audience, right? As you know, I've spent a fair amount of time in Korea, enough to make some friends there. I've worked with the church there some, preached quite a bit there in Seoul. And one of the things that came out after I'd been there for a few months and started talking to a couple of the people who have been there for a long time preaching was that there was an interesting cultural issue that actually caused a good deal of stress in the church for years as Americans were going over and teaching the Koreans. They have a holiday there that's called Chuseok. Okay? It's kind of a combination of our Thanksgiving and Christmas sort of all rolled into one. Okay? It's the biggest holiday in the country. There are 14 million people that live in the city of Seoul, and during that 1 week of Chuseok, 13.5 million of them migrate somewhere else to go back to families. It's an amazing migration in the country. Everybody's going all over the place. Buses stacked as far as you can see. There's no way you're going to try to ride a train or anything if you don't have a ticket months in advance. But they're going back to their family, to whatever is considered to be the family home. And in each of the families, there's someone who is regarded as sort of the patriarch of that family. When whoever that patriarch passes on, then there's this typical order of succession on who's the next. It's either the eldest brother in the family, or if there's no brothers there, then it looks to uncle or whatever. But it gets kind of complicated, but you get the picture. Large family gathering. One of the things that this holiday grew out of Confucianism and Buddhism, where that is a time when they would honor and worship the spirits of their ancestors. Okay? Anybody see starting to have a little problem here, right? Honor and worship the spirit of their ancestors. That's what the holiday was all about. Now, see you grinning. You're familiar with this one. Now, one of the things that they would do is they would go and clean up the cemeteries. Okay? They would go, and it's the elder brother's responsibility to assign everybody's, task to go, and they will bring food. And they like have a picnic there in the cemetery. It's almost like the Day of the Dead in Mexico in one respect. And so you'll see them as you're going around. There's hillsides where their cemeteries and things are, and the way they put their graves is a little different than ours. But people will be gathered out there, large families. And different ones will be responsible for talking and whatnot. And that whole week is supposed to be they give gifts and exchange presents, but the idea is we honor our ancestors and worship our ancestors. Now, Christianity began to come. And there were a number of denominational influences that came in, and people weren't sure exactly how to handle that, but members of the church that came in, basically their initial advice to these folks was, you just have to quit that. You just have to stop it. You cannot participate in Chuseok at all. That's a little tough from a cultural standpoint where a country is built on a large family relationship, okay, and in a respect, a deep-rooted respect for their elders. I really like that. I love going over there. Anybody with gray hair, you'd have a great time in Korea, I guarantee, because everybody's going to respect you. And I was talking to one of my friends who is a Christian, and he said what we had to struggle through and realize was the part that was in conflict with God's law was the part about worshiping your ancestors. That we now teach our children that on those days and at holidays, we still want to get together. We still want to remember where we came from. We still want to recite who our parentage were and the good things about them. And honor our family so that you will know where you came from and what your responsibilities are within the group. Because you see, that was kind of the core of what that holiday was all about. We also teach them, we only worship God. We do not worship our ancestors. Respect them, respect the family, but not worship. And you know what? I think it's a pretty good solution. It keeps the culture that is very important for that society, changes and points them in a direction of the proper worship and respect. But there were Christians from the U.S. who said, that's not sufficient. Because if you're out there on that graveside, no one can tell the difference between you and the other people who are worshiping and who aren't worshiping. And therefore, it's a problem. Absolutely. He didn't need to, right. Absolutely. And so when you look at that kind of thing, I think that was an okay thing to work out. But there were enough problems between well-meaning Christians from the States that it broke up and split up congregations over that holiday. Part of it was they didn't understand, okay? But from their standpoint, you know, I mean, that was just, you couldn't even anathema. You couldn't conceive of people even looking like they were, you know. 1 Thessalonians where it says, when you see the appearance of evil, you run away, right? Well, to them, that was participating in it. It wasn't running away from it. And I think that's exactly right. What it really boils down to there was there a point on those who said it looks like everybody else? That's a valid point. It's a valid point. But was it also a point to say, this is our culture, this is our heritage, and if we get people aimed the right way, there's nothing wrong with respecting where we came from and who our ancestors were. Point? Reasonable.
Yeah,
substitute Christmas. You got it in this country, okay? Now, how are you going to fix a situation like that? How do you guide? What's the guideline there? You read Romans 14, right? You read Romans 14. That's a perfect situation for that. Christmas is identical in this country in a lot of ways. South Florida is a very interesting place because there's two holidays that fall real close together there, right? What are they? Christmas and Hanukkah, right? Are right there. In South Florida, if you don't have a Christmas tree up, you're assumed to be Jewish. Okay? So, it just gets to be an interesting thing because there's as many Jews that sell, you know, that have a menorah in their window as there are Christians who have a Christmas tree in. But I've known people who, in particular, were converted out of religious groups where they really put an emphasis on the religious aspect of Christmas. And for them, they couldn't get that out of their mind. They'd been raised on it. That was, you know, like ingrained in them since childhood. And therefore, they did not want a Christmas tree. They did not want anything to do with it. And you know what? If that's their conscience, is there anything wrong with them not having anything to do with Christmas? No. Okay, so those are the kinds of issues that we have to be careful with as we're dealing with each other. Absolutely. Absolutely.
For them to shun it would be living your
And really what that points out is that for a lot of these issues, it's more complicated than people want to try to admit. You know, unfortunately, life is messy. Life is complicated. And that's where we have to start letting each other know that, you know, we can still talk about this, but at some point, you have to be fully convinced in your own mind that what you're doing is the right thing to do in your service to God. That's really what it boils down to. I saw a couple of other hands there. Okay. So, there are plenty of examples that we could bring up as you start looking at this, but I hope that we look at that from a standpoint of watching what we do and how we interact with others. Let's go one step further on that how we interact, because Paul slightly deals with it, but not a lot. I love the passage that says, let your speech be seasoned with what?
Salt.
Okay? Why is that? What does that mean? Let your speech be seasoned with salt. Okay, no, but I mean, what is it about salt that he's trying to get in mind? So, for example, anybody ever had a cut on their finger and then you put your hands in salt water? What happens? It hurts, right? So is that what he's talking about? Let your speech be seasoned with salt. Make sure you're hurting other people. No, that's not it, right? Exactly. When he says to be salt of the earth, what's he trying to say? A lot of people want to make that as preservative, but that's not the point. Now, yeah, salt can be a preservative. You get too much salt on something, and it doesn't taste good either, right? But if you get it done just right, salt can be a flavor enhancer. It can make food taste good, right? Now, I know we eat too much salt these days, but the idea is let your speech be seasoned with salt. You want your speech to be something that isn't irritating to other people. You want it to be something that is pleasant. And I'm not talking about just, you know, dripping honey and just always, you know, flattering people or something like that. We're talking about that on Wednesday nights. You know, that's not what he's got in mind there. So, that principle in mind, you're looking at two people that have a disagreement. What's the attitude got to be when you're talking to each other about it? What's the attitude got
to
be?
Make sure that your words are going to be received well.
Think about what you say and how you say it. Absolutely. If that's not the driving force, it's got to be love for the other person, not trying to win my argument.
You probably gave us a good example when you preached on Easter. We had some good visitors. We had people from the community. But honestly, I worshiped at a place where I knew when Easter came around, the preacher had an anti-Easter sermon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah. Age does a lot of things to you, doesn't it, Galen? As you get older, you have to make all kinds of changes and adaptations that you never expected. I'll tell you another one that you know I struggle with sometimes. Dress code in this country is changing dramatically, isn't it? Now, I personally think that there's some limits, okay, beyond which I just can't bend anymore. But most Sundays, you're going to see me in a suit and tie. Why? Am I trying to impress anybody? I hope you don't think I'm just trying to impress anybody, okay? It's not really impressive. This suit is like, you know, I've got three of them. I've had the same three suits for the last 25 years. Guys can get by with that, right? So why do I do it? Why do I do it? Because I kind of grew up that way. And for me, it was showing respect for coming together, the Lord's services. And so I want to dress to show respect. Now, is there a principle behind that? Well, anybody ever read about the garments that they made for the priests back then? And no, I'm not trying to be a priest. But anyway, the point was, as they were in worship and service to God, what does it say about their garments? What were they for? For glory and for honor to God. It's like putting your best foot forward. They had an interesting thing on the news the other night. This is the main reason I thought of this one for the example today. There was a gentleman from an electronics company who had been invited to Washington to sit in on a business discussion. It was a small panel. He was one of the randomly chosen ones. Anybody see that on the news? Yeah, I see a lot of smiles and people shaking their head. When you looked at that table, could you pick him out? Yeah. Everybody else at that table had a suit and tie on. And this guy had a short sleeve, sort of untucked shirt, open collar. Yeah. And when they asked him about it, he goes, and it's the President of the United States sitting there, by the way, okay, was heading the council. When they asked him about it afterwards, he goes, well, I kind of felt a little underdressed. Like, really? Really? Now, does that mean that I get to look down on someone who decides to come in and they don't want to wear a suit and tie? I mean, a lot of you guys out here don't have suit and ties on. Obviously, you didn't get the memo. And we got this mixture. Got some ties and some suits without ties. And, boy.
Two people can deliver a similar message, the same message, and even use nearly identical words. And one message can be accepted and the other not. And it's based on the attitude.
It is. And that's one of the reasons I hate texting for a lot of reasons. We talked about that kind of on a Wednesday night in our group, too. My wife looked over and I guess it was... who's she talking to? Sophia. And she was just, as an example, right? She goes, okay, same words. Nice dress, Sophia. Nice dress, Sophia. Right? you get same words delivered differently. Part of that is what he's talking about there in Romans 14 when he's talking about your interaction with other people. Very good point.
But the sticky part always comes in, well, what's okay to differ on? You know?
Yeah, that's hard.
Our group might say, well, you know, we're, you know, like people who believe in taking the Lord's Supper for one cup, or people who believe in not having a Sunday school, like, you know, those aren't big issues. But to them,
they are.
They're big issues.
Yes, yes. And I think what we have to do is just simply have more respect than we have. Now, are there issues and are there examples in the New Testament of where people disagreed and they actually had to kind of separate because of that disagreement? There's one in particular that always comes to mind when we're talking about this. Who's that? Anybody remember? John Mark. Yeah. He wanted to take Mark with him. Or Silas did. And, okay. Paul and Barnabas and John Mark. And John Mark is probably Barnabas's cousin, I think this is the way it works out. They come back. Apparently John Mark had left them on their first trip kind of halfway through. Paul wasn't really good with that. So when Barnabas wanted to sign him up for the second go-around, Paul says, you know what? We had some troubles because he didn't stick with us the first time. And they couldn't come to a conclusion there. So what happened? Paul and Barnabas went their separate ways. Now, you think they had a big argument and fight? Doesn't say, but it says that Barnabas took Silas. Did one of them just say, well, then I'm just not going? No, they worked it out, so they went, okay, tell you what, we'll take two journeys. We'll make two trips out of this. You go ahead and take John Mark. I'll take Silas. We'll meet up again at the afternoon. We'll see how it all went. Because you see, after that even Paul was praising John in his subsequent letters for the work that he'd been doing. So I don't think that they had a big blowout over it. Now, were there other instances where they had some discussion that they needed to have? You know, Paul said he had to talk to Peter to his face one time, right? Now, I think being Paul, he probably delivered it in a very short, he wasn't probably in his face kind of thing, but the words were very direct. He said, if you, being a Jew, choose to preach to the Gentiles, but you're not willing to associate with the Gentiles, you have a problem there. Now, what's the difference in that conversation, though? Was Peter acting in his conscience? See, Peter wasn't acting in his conscience there. Peter was outside the realm of what even Peter knew was right. And so Paul was in a corrective mode there, not in a teaching mode. You see the difference there? And so we have to be able to make that kind of distinction too. There are times when we do have to sit down and have hard conversations with people. But many times it's about things that even their conscience would tell them they know better. That's a different conversation. And we need to treat it differently. Now, still out of love. There's all of that is motivated by our regard for our brothers and our desire for them to go to heaven with us. I mean, that's really what it all boils down to, is let's keep in mind where we're trying to go. And the devil wants to take as many people to hell with him as he can. You know what, folks? We need to want to take as many people to heaven with us as we can. That should be our goal. So Romans 14 is very important for how we treat each other.
It also extends outside of these walls. Not just talking about.
Yeah, this chapter is dealing with brothers, but our attitude towards people and the way we treat people and all of those kinds of things certainly extends out. We need to treat everyone with respect. That's just... And, you know, there are a lot of people who are doing things today and in their lives that I think are just absolutely wrong. And if I get a chance to talk to them, and I do on occasion, then I don't try to soften that in the sense to say, no, I can't agree with that. But I don't want to do it from a standpoint of trying to make them feel like they're being put down or that I have some superior position of judgment over them. It's just in my understanding of the Scripture, this is wrong, and let's talk about it. And they're going to have different standards. Romans 14 is about folks who have the same standard. And that's the way we have to work with it and deal with people. It's tough. It's not an easy thing. I'm sure that, you know, if we were to poll people and come up with things that we agreed and disagreed on, we'd find a lot of them. You can't get two people together. Or was it one? Somebody said that if two people have absolutely identical ideas on everything, then one of them is redundant. That's kind of the way life is. We learn from each other. We have different ideas and things. We need to be willing to do that. Anything else? Any other comments on Romans 14 before we start?
If we do need to be firm, and we do need to have a spirit where we do not accept
There's always that possibility.
You hate me because I tell you the truth. That happens in families. That happens in cultural matters. That happens with our stance on divorce and remarriage and alcohol.
And Paul is not asking people to compromise truth. He's not asking them to do that. Okay, that's something we can't do.
I think some people would argue that, though, that they would ask us or
And there's a lot of things there that, like I said, they're not all easy. A lot of this is not easy. And that's where we have to just do the best we can with it. So take a look at verse 23. We want to end with that one. And in chapter 15 next week, we're going to be going on to some other principles that relate to this. Because he's going to say, he starts out almost the same. He says, we who are strong ought to bear the weaknesses of those without strength and not just please ourselves. But what we really have to keep in mind as we close on this in verse 23, he who doubts is condemned if he eats because his eating is not from faith. And whatever is not from faith is sin. Now there's where we have to be cognizant of what we're having people do. Okay, and how we behave. That if I don't think it's right to put a Christmas tree in my house, then I better not put one there. Okay? If I live in Korea and I don't think it's right to even have anything to do with Chuseok, then, okay, I need to isolate myself. On the other hand, if I have convinced myself that, no, I can make that separation and I can still honor the culture while being a positive influence for good and letting people know that I don't do the other, you know, the worst from the ancestors, then I'm fully convinced in my mind, then that's what I need to do. Some people say, well, that's situation ethics. Yes and no. Okay? Yes and no. What it means is that in any given situation, two people may have different things that are right and wrong for them. And we need to be cognizant of that. That just because it's not my way doesn't mean it's necessarily wrong. And that we don't want people doing something that they're not fully convinced is right. Because if we push those ideas on them and they're not fully convinced they're right, then we are putting a stumbling block in their way. We are causing them to sin. So let's be cognizant of that as we deal with each other. Okay. Thank you. Good participation. We'll turn it back over to Benjamin next week on Romans 15.